Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Dr. George Lundberg, an eminent authority and prominent writer in the medical field, was the editor of JAMA, the Journal of American Medical Association, was editor of MedPage Today. A long history of prominent commentary on the medical field, and we're really honored to have him today. And he's going to speak about, obviously, what's on everyone's topic mind, and that is how we're going to deal with medical costs and what the parameters are for how to put that into effect. Somebody did ask me, what has this got to do with philosophy and the humanities? And if we can't take care of our bodies, we don't have time to deal with anything else. So, George Lundberg. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hammond. Fellow members of the Commonwealth Club, if you're a member, raise your hand. For all our friends out there in radio land, about 90% of the people raise their hand. The rest of you are guests. You're welcome as well. Fellow physicians, any physicians? All right, there too. Thank you very much. Fellow healthcare workers, now or retired? Five, okay. Fellow patients, anybody out there a patient? The ones who didn't raise their hands, they're really patients. They can't raise their hands. Okay, very good. Fellow Medicare recipients. Okay, you don't want to disclose your age. I understand that. You don't have to. We're not taking notes or anything. But about half the people raise their hands on that as well. For the next hour or so, and there is a clock prominently placed up there, which is very handy, this is approximately what I'm hoping to do. We'll have a bit of a get acquainted session, which is what we just did a little bit. I'm going to do a survey. There's a piece of paper over here I'm going to put down, and there are a variety of things there I'm going to ask you, and I'm going to ask you to raise up your hands, and we're going to see where you fit in about 12 different areas. Then we'll tally that and see how you compare with other groups that have been asked the same set of questions relatively recently, all of which has to do with healthcare, the topic, costs, and all the trade-offs that are involved. Then I intend to circulate, 7 books, starting from a 2001 book up to a 2009 book, all of which deal almost year by year by very different authors with the topic at hand tonight. So you can circulate them around as we go, and I don't want you to steal them because they're mine. A lot of them are autographed from friends of mine who are the authors, but take your time looking at them as the hour goes on, and that's fine. And then we're going to talk specifically about healthcare costs at some length. And then we'll have discussion. I hope Socratic, which I can do, and if I don't do it right, Mr. Hammond will take over, and he'll do that right, and I could sit here in the front, and we'll see how that goes. At the end of which, there'll be this gavel that slams down again for all our friends out in radio land that will know that we're done at that point. Okay, here's a question. If you are satisfied with your own health care now, please raise your hand. About 60% have raised their hand. Very good. And if you are satisfied with the current U.S. health care system, 2010 style, raise your hand. Two hands went up. Okay, this is particularly interesting because it's been about the same in terms of percentages of Americans who've answered those two questions in about that way as long as I've been studying this, which is a long time, 20, 25 years, something like that. I finished medical school in 1957, so I've been a physician for 53 years, and I've worked very actively in health policy, health access, health costs, health quality, et cetera, for about 25 years. And that's a common question. And it generally comes out that way. I'm okay, but the system stinks. And that's why we've had so much trouble changing the system, because even though you think it stinks, you're okay. And after all, we look out for number one first, and that's the way humans are by and large, and that's the way they always are. So that's kind of at the root of the issues we're at. Now, here's a permutation of the question. When fully implemented in 2014, will the health system reform bill that has passed the United States Congress and signed by the President fix the U.S. healthcare system? If you think the answer is yes, raise your hand. Not one hand went up. I thought there'd be a two or three. Not one. All right. If you think it was a step in the right direction, raise your hand. Yeah, 60%, thereabouts. If you think we should at this point or with the next Congress repeal and replace, raise your hand. Yeah, 4 or 5. Okay. Very good. That's where we are. And the times, they are changing. A guy named Dylan said that. Not Dylan Thomas, a great Welsh poet, but Dylan Bob, the great Minnesota philosopher. But that's humanities, isn't it? Philosophy? Okay, well then, okay, we worked it in there. But that, I mean, he's turning 70 in the next couple of years, I believe, kind of like Ringo Starr just turned 70. So that was then, and this is now. And who are the great philosophers of the first decade of the 21st century? Well, Donald Rumsfeld? Mitt Romney? Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sarah Palin, Glenn Beck, Rand Paul, scary, Rachel Maddow, Noam Chomsky, yeah. Well, okay, I like Chris Rock. So Dylan sang about change, and Chris Rock has a story about change. It's pretty short, but just like you have to sing Dylan, you have to do Chris Rock in dialect. So if I offend anyone by my poor use of dialect, or even that I use it at all, I apologize in advance, but you kind of have to do that. Chris Rock on change. You know the world is going crazy when the best rapper is a white guy. The best golfer is a black guy. The tallest guy in the NBA is Chinese. The Swiss hold the America's Cup. France accuses the U.S. of arrogance. Germany won't go to war. And the three most powerful people in America in the first decade of the 21st century are named Bush, Dick, and Colon. Need I say more? Chris Rock on change. The Journal of the American Medical Association on May 15, 1991, in our first of many theme issues dedicated to caring for the uninsured and underinsured, I wrote, quote, "An aura of inevitability is upon us. It is no longer acceptable morally, ethically, or economically for so many of our people to be medically uninsured or seriously underinsured. We can solve this problem. We have the knowledge and the resources, the skills, the time, and the moral prescience. We need only clear-cut objectives and proper organization of our existing resources. Have we now the national will and leadership?" Indeed, from 1991 to 2010, we did not have the will or the leadership to make that happen. And I'll circulate for you that issue of JAMA from May 1991 with the quintessential uninsured child on the cover, a painting that we did year after year after year, the same painting, always the middle of May, for many years, with a whole issue dedicated to caring for the uninsured and underinsured. So I'll pass this around, and I do want this back. But take your time looking at it, because you'll see about 10 proposals there in 1991 as on how to fix the broken healthcare system. At that time, we had 37 million Americans uninsured. And I said, we got to take care of that. And after we did that, every year it got worse, until we got to 48 million Americans uninsured this last year. And then we did do something as a country about it, although it clearly wasn't far enough in terms of what you all say. The Senate House bill that President Obama signed into law is a far cry from what I and many others wanted, but politics is, among other descriptors, quote, the art of the possible, end quotes. How good or bad will this new legislation be for the country after full implementation by around 2014? The rule of unintended consequences will have many opportunities to play out, but let's look at some quasi-objective scores that may help inform that answer. In 1993, I published a set of 11 key factors to consider when evaluating a nation's health care. I posited that if all of them were deemed equal and each was given a 9, if ideal, then an ideal healthcare system would score 99. There are 11 such factors that I deem by my own authority, of course, as equal. There are now 12. We've put one more into that, but they will be now on the whiteboard, and we will see how you feel about them. Okay, let's go over here to the piece of paper. It's not a board. We'll see what they are. These are the 12. If you can see it from the back, your eyes are better than mine, but I will read it for you so you won't have to necessarily see it. And think about it as we go, because I'm going to ask this group to vote on all of these. The vote will simply be a show of hands as to what score you think each of these has as I go through them ad seriatim. Then I will write the number down. It seems to me like the plurality number from the group by a raise of hands, which one can do pretty well. And then at the end of which, we can tally here if there's anybody out there brought a calculator that you can figure out, since I know we never learn how to add anymore. But if you brought a calculator, you can figure out what the real number is down here. Now, the issues are access, meaning you can get it if you need it. Cost, that's pretty easy to figure out. Quality and safety are together. Quality of care is in the eye of the beholder to a large extent, and people define quality, obviously, in very different ways. Safety means, hey, when you go to see a doctor or to go to a hospital, you don't come out worse than you were when you went in. And that, of course, is one of the problems these days. This was called administrative hassle. How hard is it to work the system, get what you need? Or if you're in the system as a practicing physician or whatever, how much hassle is there? Anyway, hassle. Prevention, that means preventing you from getting sick. That's pretty easy. Primary care, family doctors, general practitioners, if there are any left, or primary care for whatever without having to go to a specialist for whatever kind of care you're getting. LTC in the Army is lieutenant colonel, but here it's long-term care. A big deal since those of us in this room are anticipated by actuarials to probably last another, on average, probably 10, 12 years. So some of us might be disabled in that process, and it's long-term care. What happens there? Health disparities is a big deal. We didn't recognize that well in 1991. Now we recognize that there are many disparities based on age, gender, race, geography, that kind of stuff, ethnicity, if that's different. Then there's the issue of physician autonomy. Physician decides, that's what happened. A countering element is patient autonomy. I'm a patient. I can get what I want. These are conflicting values. They're both very important. There's a liability issue, also known as malpractice, professional liability, and how much of an issue is that in our country at this point? And at the end, there's staying power. If you fix the thing, how long is it going to last before you have to fix it again? So those are the points. There are 12 of them. And if you think it's ideal now, you're going to vote 8. If you think it absolutely sucks now as a system, you're going to vote 0 or 1. If you think, well, I don't know, I can live with that, it's sort of, they're all right, maybe that's a 4. or somewhere in the middle there. You got the scoring system all right? Okay, let's go through it. You're speaking any way you feel. If you're speaking about it yourself, well, okay, most of you are satisfied with your care. And if you want to do that, but I'm worried about 300 million Americans, and I would personally think about it in terms of everybody rather than just me. Yes, sir.
I can almost say all of the above. One of those has an airport.
Here we have a unifier who wants to vote before we even get through them, and I can understand that, and we'll see how you vote. On the other hand, many of your fellows here would not necessarily agree with that. Let me bring the microphone, because we have people out there. No, you're not. We have people in Radioland, and they won't pick it up unless we do that.
On the question of cost, is it cost to the patient or cost for the whole country?
It is cost at all, no matter who pays the bill, because we all pay the bill sooner or later. You may pay a piece of it. Your insurance company may pay a piece of it. Somebody else might eat this part, or this might be shifted over to somebody else. It's basically cost overall, the way I look at it. You might look at it only from your own pocketbook, but I would urge you to think about it in the totality, because we all pay it sooner or later in taxes, premiums, out-of-pocket, or whatever. Or we give it away, get rid of it. Now, you must speak into the microphone if you're going to speak, and you need to speak.
No, I really think, I mean, he's just to make better sense, because you're talking to these folks on more broader.
You think you're going to probably have the same number on everything, and if you do, well, you're still going to have to do it one by one, because many people out there are not going to feel that way, based upon having done this more than once before. Okay, let's start at the, we can start at the bottom, but I don't think so. I think we'll start at the top. I know you can jury-rig these surveys, but this is not that many questions. I think we'll be okay on that. Access to, let's say, basic health care, not necessarily cosmetic health care, but basic health care across the board for our country in general. Ideal would be an 8. How many like 8 now? Couple? 7. 1. 6. 3. 5. 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay, that comes out about a 4. If we did that in a statistically valid way, comes out about a 4. Now, this is now. This is not 2014 when this whole thing is played out. All right, cost of care across the board in general. Ideal, 8. The worst, 1. 8. 1, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, about a 2. That's why you're here tonight, because that's what we build. And, yes, we're going to talk about that in detail. Quality and safety. The quality is high and you're safe and you're fine with that and you know everybody else is fine with that. That's an 8. If you're scared and the quality stinks, that's a 1. So how many 8? 2, 7, 4, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Pretty good spread there, probably a 4. Administrative hassle. Is it really easy or is it really hard to get what you need? Get paid for and all that stuff. Get an appointment, get follow-up and all that stuff. If it's really great, no problem. That's an 8. How many 8s? 1, 2, 3, 4, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. That gets a 3. Pretty bad. Prevention. How are we doing as a country? Preventing disease, promoting health. 8 is the best. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Boy, you guys are really down on us. We got a 2 there. Primary care. Don't have to worry about specialists. You're going to get that primary care doc going to take care of you. no problem for whatever reason, and they get you a specialist when you really need one. Okay? The best, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We get about a 4 there again. Long-term care. How are we doing as a country with long-term care? I've been taking care of my 95-year-old cousin by remote in a nursing home for the last 6 months. She died 2 weeks ago, but I managed to see inside from that viewpoint the long-term care situation. I won't comment one way or the other, but how are we fixed for that? Let's start at the bottom now. Let's go from 1 to 8. 1 would be the worst, and then we'll move up to the best, which would be 8. How many 1s? 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We get a 3 there. Disparities, meaning no matter where you live, what your race, your sex, your gender, your age, etc., you're going to get pretty evenly spread about the same kind of care regardless.
Is that just the United States or the world?
This is only the United States we're talking about. We are not talking about any other country, and that's very important, very important. Because all the countries are different. They really are. Okay, disparities, the best, we're fine. There's no disparity. That's an 8, or a lot of disparity would be a 1. How many 8s? 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We get about a 3. Liberally, it could even be a 2. Physician autonomy, doctor can decide, that's what's going to happen. Assuming, I'm not saying it's a good value or not, but that's the value. And doctor decide, doctor knows best, that's what happens. That would be an 8, doesn't happen at all, that's a 1. How many 8s? 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, a 5 there. That's one of the best scores for the system. Patient autonomy. I get what I need. I decide. I get it. 8 would be the best. 1 is the worst. 8s, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. It spreads, but it's pretty close to a 5. That's almost the same. Very good. The malpractice issue, liability, defensive medicine, all that kind of stuff. 8 would be, it's not a problem at all. 1 is a really bad problem. So for the country at large, so let's see what your perception is. How about a 1, a really bad problem? 1, couple. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We got about a 3 there. Staying power. Sir?
That's a very ambiguous question.
Yeah, it is. They all are in a sense. That's why we're spreading them out and why this is in no way scientific, but it is an indication, and they all can be dissected for hours or days. It's very complicated. Of course, you're right. But thank you for playing the game with me anyway. I appreciate that. And finally, staying power. Where we are now, we don't have to change it. Great. We can just leave it the way it is. That would be 8. 1 is, we got to change this sucker. Okay. How many 8s? 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay, that fits with what you said earlier. That's about a 2. One of my friends out there with the adding machine can add that up if they choose to. It's 4-0? 4-0? Did I hear it right? Now I know why Mr. Hammond is in charge of this program. He knows how to add. The interesting part of that, to me, is when I did this with all consumers in Santa Rosa, about 300 people a few months ago, at a conference on prevention, attended mostly by vegans, a very interesting group of people, the same thing came out as 40. Exactly. When I did this with only physicians in the East Bay and Hayward at a medical staff meeting, maybe 60 physicians. At a lunch meeting, we did it, and it came out 40.5. Different numbers on different lines, but the same number, and we got 40 north. That's pretty amazing. That's not scientific, but it's getting there with that kind of consistency. Okay. After those 17 years at the Journal of the American Medical Association, I had 10 years at Medscape, which the last 8 of which was owned and operated by WebMD, doing nothing but internet medicine. Medscape's for the doctors, health professionals of all kinds. WebMD is for consumers in general. Then for the last 4 months, I've been with MedPage Today, which is kind of like Medscape out of New Jersey, plus Cancer Commons out of Palo Alto, a startup. Now, I'm going to circulate the books I promised. No, I want to do them one by one.
Oh, okay.
Okay. The first one is 2001. It's called Severed Trust, Why American Medicine Not Been Fixed. I wrote that, distributed it. It's on Amazon, paperback, and sort of set the tone for the decade, actually, although I hoped it wouldn't. I hoped we'd fix things. And again, I get no money from any of these things because they're just books. And you get buy that on Amazon for like $3 plus postage currently. This is then, a year or two later, George Halverson, who now runs Kaiser Permanente, and his associate from Minneapolis, George Isham, Epidemic of Care, A Call for Safer, Better, and More Accountable Healthcare. This is about 2003. That's what it's about, epidemic of care. All kinds of care you get, you don't need. But you get charged for it, somebody pays, and that's your big lesson about the costs of medical care. As tonight. If that's all you remember, you got it. You got it, but we're going to detail that. Then out of Seattle, Richard Dio, Hope or Hype. Dio is best known for his work on back pain and how you don't need surgery for it, hardly ever, ever, ever. Don't let anybody cut on you. And he has other stuff. Hope or Hype, that's a large part of it. And then David Cundiff, now in Southern California, did Money-Driven Medicine, Tests and Treatments That Don't Work. This was a year or two later. And Maggie Mahar has another one, also written the same name, but it's a different author, Money-Driven Medicine. Regina Hertzlinger, professor of business, Harvard Business School, a big pusher for consumer-directed healthcare, had Who Killed Healthcare, and her chapters are, because they tell the story, Reggie says, Who Killed Healthcare? Killer number one, the health insurers. Killer number two, the general hospitals. Killer number three, the employers. Killer number four, the United States Congress. Killer number five, the academics. Killer number six, no, five is enough, I guess. Then we go to how to fix the thing in general and carrots, sticks, laws, and so forth. Reggie's very outspoken, has her answers. Some of them might even be right. Then we have my favorite book from 2008. And that's Worried Sick by Norton Hadler out of the University of North Carolina. if you choose to buy any of these books, buy this one and read it. It's extremely well written, very well referenced for an intelligent, non-physician, non-medical audience about all the stuff that's going on out there that you don't need to do and why you don't need to do it, even though all your doctors say you got to do this and all the drug ads say you got to do this and all the direct-to-consumer marketing and advertising says you got to do this, and on and on and on. You don't got to do this, and this is a, he tells you why. Norton Hadler, one of my favorite people. And then after Norton's book, a little over a year ago, came out a much smaller book from a guy I don't know. I know all these other people, but Dennis Gottfried from Connecticut, I guess, a book about half the size of Norton Hadler's Worried Sick called Too Much Medicine. A Doctor's Prescription for Better and More Affordable Healthcare, 2009. Now, Norton Hadler has a newer book out, which I couldn't find at home. My wife must have given it to somebody or something. I don't know. But she's in the back row, so I'm not telling tales. It's called Stabbed in the Back. And it's also, it's basically about back pain. And all the docs who've made huge amounts of money and all the manufacturers made huge amounts of money out of cutting on your back, and it doesn't need to be done, and it doesn't do any good. It might make you worse. Once in a while, it's necessary, but 9 times out of 10, it isn't. And it tells that whole story and cautions you about protecting yourself, basically against getting stabbed in the back by somebody. Hadler Professor, University of North Carolina. So while you're perusing those and passing them around, we'll move on. My current employer, Halftime, is MedPage Today. You can go there. Why? You don't even have to register. If you do, you can get emails and stuff. But www.medpage, MedPage.com. And fresh medical information, cleanly written, clean as a whistle, no conflicts of interest. Really, really well done by people writing very crisply every day the best, most important medical news for a physician audience, but everybody's welcome, and it's free. And I wrote a thing in my at-large column there, less than a month ago, called What Are the Primary Drivers of Rising Healthcare Costs? In early June 2010, MedPage Today posted a survey question asking readers to identify primary drivers of rising healthcare costs. Now, most of the readers are physicians, and they voted. Again, not scientific, a survey, but 1,200 readers voted. And they were given these choices they could answer. One was increased insurance premiums. One was new technology. One was malpractice costs. One was drug costs. One was increased physician payment. One was other. And 1,200 people voted. 24% said increased insurance premiums. 22% said new technology, 22% said malpractice costs in the broadest scale, and yes, it is complicated, sir. It is much more complicated than that, obviously. 12% said drug costs, and 3%, remember these are physicians mostly voting, 3% said increased physician payments. So there may be a little bias there, and 16% voted other. Well, I read that, and I said, I don't believe that. So I did the survey, I took the thing, and I voted other. So I wrote an editorial about that, and I said, I voted other. This survey, like most, misses the main point. It is the decisions of patients and physicians that are the principal drivers of healthcare costs. Not all that other stuff, it's the decisions. This survey does not provide that answer to choose. Finger-pointing elsewhere by the responsible individual is typical. Somebody else is wrong, not me. Yeah. Here is my view. These are the main drivers of healthcare costs. Number one, patients with insurance who consider medical care a freebie with no cost consequences. That's a huge driver. How many times have you been to the doctor and so he said, he or she says, well, we need to do this and this, and don't worry about it, insurance will cover it. Or you ask, will insurance cover it? We've built an entire society for decades based on, well, if insurance covers it, must be okay. Go ahead and do it. That's really stupid as a society, although it might be smart for individuals, and it's certainly been the basic sociology for a very long time. Not as long as you might think. I mean, my parents didn't have any health insurance at all. And I didn't have any when I was growing up. And I was sick a lot. But since the 60s, and for some people, a good bit before that, there's been a lot of health insurance for a lot of people. Number two big driver, physicians who neither practice evidence-based medicine nor include cost in their decisions. Physicians who say, well, we'll order some of these. You say, you don't, but if you did say, well, how much is it going to cost? Physician won't know. Well, insurance will pay for it, I think. Three, the absence of realistic cost transparency. I've been talking about this since the 70s. I'm a pathologist. I used to run the labs down at L.A. County USC Medical Center. We built the biggest hospital lab in the world down there the 10 years I was there. It was before I came up to Davis as professor and chair of pathology, and I ran the labs in Sacramento at the medical center. But the docs would order all these lab tests. They had no idea how much they cost. Well, we'll get some of these and some of those. And transparency means you know. I used to say in the 70s, you go to Sears Roebuck, Montgomery Ward, or even Saks Fifth Avenue, and you look at a tag, it'll tell you what it's going to cost. Why not a lab test? Well, Number four. This is important. This is a malpractice statement. Number four. Decisions driven by the pervasive mystique of, quote, defensive medicine, end quotes, which now dictates hugely expensive, paren, and lucrative, paren, defensive practice standards. For so many decades, the threat of being sued by a doctor or to an institution has caused a complete social belief that we have to protect ourselves against lawsuit, even if I've never been sued, and the chances are very small percent I'm ever going to be sued. I have to protect myself against that, and they have produced that as a mystique, as a pervasive, and now it's built into practice standards. So you go to anywhere in California which has the best legal system to keep malpractice insurance costs down, called MICRA, since the 1970s, hasn't affected the defensive medicine issue at all. Now it becomes standard of practice to do all that stuff, document in the chart, so if some lawyer comes fishing, hey, we did that. That's why you can't get an acute appendix diagnosed and taken out without a CAT scan of your belly. What? That's now standard. This is a really big driver. Okay, number five. Hospitals that want to fill beds. Hey, we got to fill them all. Bad business if they're not all full because we have fixed costs, whether or not they're there. Especially ICU beds make the most money off those ICU beds. Stanford, where I'm a consulting professor, I've heard it rumored that an ICU bed with full treatment at Stanford is $30,000 a day. Hey, let's be sure they're all full. Doctor, come on, put them there, you know. Yeah. Aggressively market the newest and most expensive technology. Hey, you come to our place, you get the fanciest stuff there is. You go over there, they don't have that fancy new stuff. No, it doesn't work any better than the old stuff, but we got to pay it off somehow. So you better come over here. The community will be proud of you because we have the fancy new one. And all kinds of tests and treatments that patients often just don't need. They do them very well, but mostly you don't need them. Number six, insurance companies primarily care about making money for their owners and senior executives. Seven drug companies that successfully push use of their most expensive drugs. That's really a dominant thing. The whole bit, keep the patent as long as you can. Pay off the generic manufacturer to not enter the market, bribe them with billions of dollars, which they'll get for not selling. It's kind of like the government paying a farmer to not grow a crop. I mean, we taught them how to do it as a government. So you pay them, and that keeps them out. There's legislation right now being considered to change that, but, that'll be a fight because they got the smartest lobbyists, and, are they good, really good. The extraordinary success of American marketing as a dominant cultural behavior. I started saying again in the 70s that the biggest American triumph sociologically has been marketing. We're really good at that. Now, those are reasons for drivers. And here are seven ways to reduce unnecessary medical costs right now. And I wrote this in the healthcare blog about a year ago. It's all there, all written. You can find it easily. Go to Google, stick in my name and say reduce unnecessary medical costs, and bang, you're right there. Open access healthcare blog. after the preamble, etc. An alliance of patients and physicians can widely apply recently learned comparative effectiveness science to big-ticket items, saving vast sums while improving quality of care. These are the big seven. There are more, but these are the big ones. Number one, intensive medical therapy should be substituted for coronary artery bypass grafting, which at the time of this writing was about 500,000 procedures a year. We call them cabbages, crack open the chest and do all this fancy stuff in the coronary arteries, open surgery. For many patients with established coronary artery heart disease, saving many billions of dollars annually, they don't need cabbages, especially on stable angina. Now, the reason cabbages were started, Michael DeBakey did the first one that was reported, was published in JAMA in the 1970s. You figure you've got an artery and it's got all this stuff clogging it up. Anybody who knows about pipes at home knows rust in the pipes, you got to get rid of it or the pipe's going to clog up. Well, your artery's the same way. It makes sense. Well, you need to cut it up. You need to ream it out. Sensible, but the data don't support it except for left main stem coronary artery disease. Then it supports it with about a 3% difference between coronary artery bypass graft and intensive medical therapy. The rest of them, by and large, you don't need it. Now, you go to any hospital around, their big cash cow is that procedure right now. And second to that is the other big procedure, which is invasive angioplasty and stenting, currently about 1 million procedures per year, most of which don't need to be done because intensive medical therapy doesn't. My wife keeps telling me I have to move more rapidly. I thought I had till 7 o'clock. Is that not true? Yeah, okay. When am I supposed to be done, Mr. Hammond? That's what I thought. Okay, very good. So that's the other big one, 1 million a year, mostly not needed. The cardiologist, it's their bread and butter. And it's more than bread and butter. It's a lot more than bread and butter. Number three, non-indicated PSA screening for prostate cancer should be stopped. You don't need it. And the best editorial in the lay press this year was the guy who discovered or invented PSA screening, wrote an editorial for an Arizona newspaper which said, I'm sorry, I wish I'd never found it because it's caused much more harm than good, and I would like it abolished. That's the guy who created it. It was a mea culpa sort of thing. Mostly PSA, just don't do it. Get you in more trouble. Generally, once in a while, there's a situation you might track something that can be beneficial. But I say non-indicated PSA screening. Boy, the hospitals and the urologists went wild with PSA. Come here, we'll find your prostate cancer and keep you alive. Larry King did it. And on and on and on. It's a big problem and one now we know better than. Screening mammography in women under 50 who have no clinical indication should be stopped, and for those over 50, sharply curtailed, since it now seems to lead to at least as much harm as good. And when the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force came out with that recommendation, well after I had written this, they got decimated. And our Secretary of our Assistant Secretary for Health and the Secretary of Health and Human Services backed down from science, bowed over to politics, and made the Preventive Services Task Force, which was absolutely right, right on, bad PR, but right science, look dumb. And that was really stupid. There was a chance.
The same recommendation, set of recommendations also recommended women no longer examine their own breasts.
That is, the Preventive Services Task Force stated that there's been no scientific evidence that it's any good for women to examine their own breasts in terms of whether they will or won't die of cancer. That is correct. That was the same recommendation, and that's what the science is. And that goes against 50 years of teaching, so you have a social obvious, you got to do this, when all of a sudden science says, hey, you don't need to do that. It takes a long time to turn that ship around. Number five, CAT scans and MRIs are impressive art forms. They are beautiful, and they can be useful clinically now and then. However, their use is unnecessary much of the time to guide correct therapeutic decisions. Such expensive diagnostic tests should not be paid for on a case-by-case basis, but grouped along with other diagnostic tests by some capitated or packaged methods that's use neutral. Again, all of these things save tens of billions of dollars. And I'm 77, and I never had a CAT scan, and I never had an MRI, and I'm hopeful I never will, although they're an occasion that maybe, but not yet. Number six, we must stop paying huge sums to oncologists and their institutions for administering chemotherapeutic false hope, along with real suffering from adverse effects to patients with widespread hopeless metastatic cancer. More billions saved. Palliative care is what you do, and then you go to hospice in that situation. It's much better for the patient. Seven, death, which comes to us all, should be as dignified and free from pain and suffering as possible. We should stop paying physicians and institutions for prolonging dying with false hope, bravado, and intensive therapy that only adds to their profit margin. Such behavior is almost unthinkable and yet is commonplace. More billions saved. Before we go to completely open discussion, how can you protect yourself? If your doctor says, we're going to do this, this, and this, you should say, why are you doing that? Why are you ordering that test, procedure, or treatment? Second, how will it help me? Is it safe? Is it effective? Third, how much will it cost? Anybody, not just me. Fourth, is there a less expensive alternative if it turns out to be really expensive? If it's not really expensive, okay, fine, as long as it's safe. And also, doctor, how much do you or your organization make from ordering that test or procedure? And if you pass that test, then I'll let you do it. Otherwise, go away. I'll find myself another doctor. Which leads me to, I already said I'm 77, and my longtime doctor retired, so I recently had to get a new primary care physician. After a couple of visits and some lab tests, she said I was doing fairly well for my age. I was a little concerned about that comment, so I couldn't resist asking her, do you think I'll live to 80? She said, do you smoke tobacco or drink alcohol? I said, no, I don't do that, and I don't do other drugs either. She said, well, do you eat ribeye steaks and barbecued ribs? I said, no, my other doctor said that was very unhealthy. Do you spend a lot of time in the sun, like playing golf, sailing, hiking, bicycling? I said, no, I don't do that. I stay out of the sun. She said, do you gamble, drive fast cars, have a lot of sex? I said, no, I don't do any of those things either. She said, then why do you give a damn whether you beat get to age 80? Now we're to picking up the mic and letting our leader, Mr. Hammond, entertain you Socratically. Thank you.
Thanks, George, for that great talk. Now, I'll just ask one leading question, then we'll open it up. On the issue of a lot of the costs that you're out to save and everything have to do with the non-acceptance of death, basically, in our society, and that's obviously a very important philosophical topic over the centuries. So we can have at least one little discussion about that. Do you think that our society, in particular, denies the existence of death? I mean, this was a big hot topic when we were young in the 60s and everything, and the youth culture and everything. But do you think that has anything to do with the fact that we're running into this problem here now?
It has a lot to do with it, and I indicated that in my last statement. That was one of the things that we're trying to deny death, and obviously we all die. And by and large, 85 is the time for death for most of us, no matter what, unless something happens to us before that, and a few will go beyond that, and then they'll have the 60, 70, 80% Alzheimer's. But 85 is about the mid-80s is the number that we seem genetically programmed to die at. It was a joke back when I lived in Southern California that in Marin County, death was an option. But I know that's not true. I'm a pathologist, remember. Not an option. But it is how we deal with death and dying is a big deal. And I did a videotaped an editorial in New Jersey last Thursday on death called Death is Not the Enemy. And it'll be about a 2.5 minute on MedPage Today in about 4 weeks. Yeah, we have to just deal with reality better and not try to prevent it. It's normal, and at some point it should be acceptable, and I already indicated that the ways to do that are on the way towards hospice.
And you say at some point it should be acceptable, and I would go one step forward. At some point it's desirable.
There's no question but that death is desirable compared to some elements of life.
Yeah.
And a lot
after
of people would feel that way, although it's hard to say because some people say, no, I want to live no matter what. And I guess that's okay, their choice. But for many people, you keep them going. It's like torture. Yeah. Torture. Yeah.
Two questions. Is Kaiser a good example for controlling costs, and could it be extended to the nation? And number two, Canada, much less expensive. I know a few Canadians that are happy with theirs, even though some of the pharmaceutical medical associations put out propaganda against it.
There are some really good examples of how to do medicine right in the country. The largest one is Kaiser Permanente for a long, long time. There are people who like it, people who don't like it, but overall, based on satisfaction scores, real quality scores, safety scores, when measured against costs, it's been a very good system. The Geisinger system up in northern Pennsylvania is written up by the Times. New York Times loves Geisinger, and they do a lot of things very, very well. Cleveland Clinic does a lot of things well. Mayo, in its various places, does a lot of things well. But frankly, probably the best medicine in America, other than those of us who are in medicine and are able to use our own connections to get in there, that we generally do very well. But overall, the Veterans Administration medicine, since Ken Kaiser turned that around about 10 years ago, is outstanding. Outstanding. And the Department of Defense, I was in the Army 11 years as an Army doctor, Vietnam, wartime, that kind of stuff. But military medicine is very good, totally run by government. VA medicine is very good, totally run by government, and those are examples of how to do it right.
I'm a surgeon, cardiac surgeon, actually. Do all those coronary bypass operations.
I'm glad you made it back here.
Yes, all right.
It was just nice.
I think the common factor is the fact that we are so involved with as a capitalistic society. In other words, death is basically prevented, or at least it's because you can make money off of that. And that everything that you listed on your health drivers was involved with making money. And the countries that don't have the same kind of problems we do with both quality and cost have basically controlled this by taking the practice of medicine out of the marketplace.
Yes.
And I fully agree with you. I was also in the Army for several years.
Yeah.
And my view is the Army medicine, the military medicine, is the best. There's the conflicts that you just listed off there don't exist.
It's hard to bill a corpse. On the other hand, lawyers do it all the time by attaching estates.
Lots of people
and so
around those corpses, though, this will pay.
On the other hand, you know, one of the things people are willing to...
George is a lawyer.
A lot of him, but not that kind. people are willing to spend a lot of money for extra time living, and you know, just one thing that did happen in my family. I have my father is one of 11 children, and he had, you know, so there were 8 boys, and the 2 oldest and the father both died of coronary disease in their mid-60s, and the other, all the other 6 boys were old enough at the time to get coronary bypasses. And every single one of them had bypass surgery, and they all lived to an average of 82 years of age instead of 65. So if something really does, I mean, that's not the kind of arterial thing you were talking about. This is, you know, something else. But if everybody could get another 15 years, they'd be willing to pay a lot of money for that.
But your implication is that there was a cause-effect there, and almost certainly there wasn't.
Ah.
They probably think there was, but there probably wasn't.
Well, the biggest effect, I'll tell you, is that the next generation all had a much better diet.
Thank you. That was a very interesting talk. I want to introduce another consideration that your analysis hasn't included, not that you haven't thought about it, but it isn't part of your talk this evening. There's a study that was done by a professor of psychiatry at George Washington University. His name is David Reese, and it was a study of the impact of family support on survival for people who were suffering from terminal illnesses. And the question he was asking is, what was the value of a supportive family in terms of the person's survival with a terminal illness? And the finding was that when you compared dysfunctional families and functional families, the patients from functional families, on average, lived a year less than the ones from dysfunctional families. Right? Now, he looked into that, and the finding was that the problem was that in intact functioning families, they were able to have the wherewithal and give permission to the patient to die. In the dysfunctional families, they weren't, and because of that, medical heroics kicked in. And it wasn't that the quality of living was better, but rather that medical heroics sustained them with a very poor quality of life. So that's by way of calling attention to factors external to the medical care system that are contributing to the cost you're talking about.
That's a very interesting study. I was not aware of that particular study. Thank you very much for calling it to our attention. A similar fact was that in the middle 1970s, when California had not put into effect malpractice controls in terms of costs of insurance, there was a doctor strike in the San Fernando Valley, which went on for not a long time. But when people look back at that doctor strike, while the doctors were on strike, the death rate went down. Really? And I was working at L.A. I was working in L.A. County at that time. Wow, they should stay on strike.
Thank you. Thank you for speaking. I noticed that you didn't mention the incidence of deaths due to medication side effects. And, of course, that's considered 10 years ago was estimated at 100,000, whereas the deaths from lack of insurance was 47,000. And after practicing family medicine for over two decades, I finally became fed up with the dishonesty of the pharmaceutical industry. And I've discovered as you go back through the literature, there's copious amounts of information that was left out of our textbooks, apparently on purpose, so we wouldn't know about effective dietary management, nutrition. We wouldn't know about sleep apnea as a major problem, a major driver. And so when we can't accurately diagnose patients, how can we give cost-effective care?
Your point is well taken. I wish to differ with one of your statistics in terms of studies saying that lack of insurance had a resultant 49,000 additional deaths that would not have been there had they been insured. That those data, I think, are valid. The 100,000 deaths you're referring to is error in medicine deaths, patient safety issues, not only drug problems of the wrong drug, the wrong dosage form, additional. Those are part of it, but they're not the whole thing. There are many other things that entered into the patient safety problem with 100,000 deaths per year, which is an Institute of Medicine number, but it incorporates what you said, but that's not only medication error.
Does it incorporate the issue of misdiagnosis?
It incorporates a whole lot of stuff, and I refer you to the Institute of Medicine's report on it's all on the patient safety movement, but it's entitled "To Err Is Human," and there's a whole book on that. The 100,000 is legit, but there are many things in it.
Yeah. Okay. Now we've come to the end of the hour. We have time for just one more question. There'll be time for other questions after the time is over. You can just ask for it yourself.
How do you feel about alternative forms of medicine, such as osteopathy, homeopathy, and the supplements to get away from pharmaceuticals? natural herbs and such.
Okay, I'll give you my stock answer, which is there is no alternative medicine. There's only medicine. Medicine that has been tested, found to be safe and effective. Use it, pay for it. Medicine that has been tested, found to be not safe or not effective. Don't use it, don't pay for it. Medicine that's never been tested. If it's plausible, makes sense, test it. If it works, put it in one pile. If it doesn't work, put it in the other pile. As to the listings you had, osteopathy is not alternative medicine. Osteopathy is simply another form of standard medicine. It uses manipulative techniques more, and in most states in this country, you go to osteopathic school, you get an MD, or you get a degree that's the same as an MD. But the other things you mentioned, there's a whole string of them, and that's a topic for another night in depth, because much of what I said in that area would cause many people to disagree and to disagree with fervor, but that's the way I sort it out.
Well, once again, thanks, George, for that great presentation. And we also thank our audience here at the club, as well as those listening on the radio or online. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, held during its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.